Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In Russia, Prime Minister Vladimir Putin suggests the Bush administration orchestrated the Georgia conflict to influence the U.S. election. In Pakistan, the leading candidate to replace Pervez Musharraf as president is under guard amid security fears. And in Iraq, the U.S. prepares to hand over control to Iraqi forces in the province once at the center of the Sunni insurgency. Joining me for the Friday News Roundup, Michael Hirsch of Newsweek, Tom Jelton of National Public Radio, and Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I think we must begin this discussion, gentlemen. It's always good to see you all, by referring to John McCain's vice presidential choice and how you see Sarah Palin, the governor of Alaska, in terms of foreign affairs. Moises.
The reality is that for experts in foreign affairs, that's not a name that rings any bells. She's not well known. We don't know anything about her positions about international affairs. We don't know how experienced, how well traveled, what are her thoughts. And what does, who does she know in the world of international leaders? And therefore, the assumption here is that the candidate McCain is assuming that he is covering and he's offering the United States voters reassurances about international security and international affairs because of his experience, and that therefore he needed something else to cover and complement his ticket.
Michael Hirsch.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an extremely risky choice because at the back of a lot of voters' minds, when they decide about McCain versus Obama, is going to be McCain's age, 72, the oldest president to be sworn in for the first time, a guy who, you know, if he does get to two terms, would be 80. Questions have been raised about his command of the facts, you know, even now. And there is the issue of his health. He's twice had melanoma. He's been declared free of cancer. But you know, these are issues that made people think that a VP choice is perhaps more important for the McCain ticket than it would be normally.
Tom.
Well, Diane, I think the reasons for choosing her are obvious, that she does have a reputation in Alaska as a reformer, and this sort of perhaps reinforces the McCain image as a maverick, which he's trying to, you know, recover because it's sort of been lost in the last few months. And this probably indicates that he's trying to sort of go back to that image. Nevertheless, I just don't see how the McCain campaign is going to be able to continue making a big issue of Obama's inexperience in foreign affairs when the person who will now be a heartbeat away from the presidency, should McCain win, has arguably less experience than Obama does.
And it's interesting, on a day when we hear that Vladimir Putin is making some pretty serious allegations against the Bush administration, talk about what they are and why he is making those now, Moises.
President Putin, in an interview with CNN, argued that the reason why Georgia went ahead with the war was motivated or provoked or pushed by American electoral calculations. Well, that brings us back to the Wag the Dog movie, where there was a story of a presidential candidate that started a war just to get some advantage in the polls and win the election. And, you know, the White House responded that that was an absurd statement. But we know that President McCain has been close with President Saakashvili of Georgia. Cindy McCain was just there this week in a humanitarian.
You mean Senator McCain, Moises?
No, the wife of Senator McCain.
No. Oh, but you said President McCain. I just want to correct that.
Ahead of, and so there is the notion that the President Saakashvili and the leadership in Georgia, in fact, many of them are trained in the United States. They know very well how to operate in the system. They had an advantage after the events in terms of international public opinion. And so the Russians decided to counter that international public relations offensive. And there were articles by President Medvedev in the Financial Times this week. And therefore, President Putin's appearance in CNN explaining that this is nothing but electoral politics in the United States, and that it was a very dangerous game to play.
So in response, the Bush administration has now said that in light of Russia's recent attacks in Georgia, it's going to review its planned talks with Moscow on missile defense and nuclear armament. Where are we headed with this, Tom?
Boy, Diane, it sure seems like we're headed backwards rapidly to the 1980s and the height of the Cold War. I mean, there's a long list of things that have happened here in the last week that really raise that prospect. In fact, we had Prime Minister Medvedev saying that Russia does not fear going back to a Cold War. And we had a high Russian official this week making some very alarming statements about Ukraine. And I think this is where the focus is now turning. Ukraine is the former Soviet republic, which is closest now at this point to EU membership, but it has a very unstable political situation with a large Russian population. The opposition there is pro-Russian, and a senior Russian official suggested that the new front line of the Cold War runs straight through Ukraine. A very scary statement.
Which is, frankly, where Putin wanted it. Not right through Ukraine, but on the outside. I mean, Putin, to give him some credit, has repeatedly warned that there was a red line in front of Georgia and Ukraine. He was not going to permit them to be admitted into NATO, even though these latest allegations about this being done for electoral reasons in the U.S. has absolutely no evidence to back it up. There is a legitimate criticism that we've been pushing Russia's buttons a little too hard, even as Russia changed and, you know, became wealthier and more assertive. And I agree with Tom. I mean, the Ukraine is the next front. There is the betting, from what I'm hearing, inside NATO now, and there's a real dispute going on inside NATO between the hard lines and the more Western Europeans who, as always, want to take a little slightly softer line, that perhaps we should just let Russia sort of stew in its own juices. For example, one of the impacts in Ukraine now could be this very strong pro-Russia party Tom referred to in the eastern Ukraine, which has always argued, we can get along with Russia. You know, they're not going to cause us any trouble. I mean, that sort of political platform has now been undermined, and so you may see politically a much stronger Western tilt inside Ukraine, even as Putin attempts to take a hard line.
Moises.
And that gets into one of the very thorny issues, which is the national integrity of a country. And when can a country be defined as such, and when it becomes a runaway republic? The Russians invaded Georgia to ensure the independence, and actually this week they declared the independence of Ossetia and Abkhazia. At the same time in which they are bombarded Chechnya almost out of existence, which is another region that wanted to have the kind of independence that these two countries have. And to make it even more complicated this week, Russia's reached out to China and tried to get China to support it. And didn't get it, because China has its own territorial integrity problems. And when they talk about that, they think in big red light is Tibet, which also has, and there are several regions inside China that are also may claim similar conditions. And therefore, one of the aspects is that Russia has become very isolated. Mm-hmm. The only ones that have come in favor of Russia in this have been Hamas, Belarus, and President Chavez.
The question I want to go back to is, once again, the charge that Putin is making. Is there any evidence whatsoever that indeed the move by Georgia into South Ossetia and elsewhere was motivated and pushed and helped by the U.S. in order to influence the election? Tom.
Well, you added something there at the end, Diane, that I think disqualifies everything. There is absolutely no evidence that this had anything to do with the U.S. presidential election. There are some interesting things to consider, however, and I'm not referring to this American passport that was found in one of the ruined buildings that was held up by a Russian official as evidence that the Americans were involved on the ground. A single American passport turns up in a building, big deal. However, it is true that the U.S. military has had a close relationship with the Georgian military as recently as July, holding military exercises and really sort of taking a lead role in professionalizing the Georgian military. And, of course, the Georgians had a contingent in Iraq. So there's no question that the United States and Georgia have had a close military and tightening military-to-military relationship. Now, does that mean that the United States is sort of goading Georgia on? I think that would be quite a leap to come to that conclusion. But there is a, let's say, legitimate basis for some concern here on Russia's part.
Tom Jelton of NPR, Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine, and Michael Hirsch of Newsweek. Short break, and then your questions, comments a little later in the program. 800-433-8850. Welcome back. Here's our first email on the issue of Georgia, the Russians, and the West. It's from Eric, who says, the LA Times reports that Joseph Wood, Vice President Cheney's Deputy Assistant for National Security Affairs, quote, was in Georgia shortly before the war began. James Gerzenstang wonders what Wood was doing there. Sergei Markov, a senior political scientist close to Vladimir Putin, claimed recently that the war was part of a plot by Dick Cheney to help John McCain. Michael Hirsch.
Again, I mean, it's always difficult figuring out what the reticent Dick Cheney is up to, but there is no evidence. The fact that a Cheney official was there, I mean, there were a lot of U.S. officials there advising the Georgians, advising Mikhail Saakashvili, the Georgian president. The Bush administration maintains that it warned him not to respond to Russian provocations. There are lingering questions about how strong that warning is, which, you know, has these weird echoes of what happened in the first Persian Gulf before about what we told Saddam before he invaded Kuwait. And at the same time, while I dismiss many of these conspiracy theories based on U.S. electoral politics, I think it is a fair criticism to say that perhaps we encouraged Saakashvili too much, too quickly. There were measures of caution in terms of the training up of the Georgian military. We held back on some things like air training. But nonetheless, against the warnings of Putin, which we dismissed as mere bluster, that he was not going to permit NATO into Georgia and Ukraine, which after all are two countries that the Russian elites have always seen as part of the greater Russia going back a couple centuries, we basically ignored him. And so, there is the question of whether our diplomacy could have been better, more effective.
So what does all this mean for Georgia's possible entry into NATO, Moises?
It's being debated. It's very it's part of the conversation, but it's part of a larger conversation, which is the role of NATO. There is a meeting of foreign ministers, of European foreign ministers, that has been convened on Monday. To discuss what are other reactions, what other decisions will be made to counter Russia's presence and permanent, that is becoming more and more, looks like it's going to be more and more permanent. They are seem to be entrenched now in some parts of Georgia. So and then there is, of course, the issue of Ukraine and what happens there. That raises challenges that are far more important. There is also the notion that a very senior general, a Russian general, a week ago, after Poland signed a missile defense agreement with the United States, then said, well, now that means that we're going to target Poland again is going to be part of our list of targeted for our nuclear ballistic systems. So, threatening Poland with atomic bombs and doing the Georgia thing, plus the statements that have been made with about the Ukraine, raises very large issues about what's the role and what's the function and what's the existence of NATO for.
But what leverage does the U.S. now have in regard to Russia, Tom?
Well, the immediate agreement that is in jeopardy is the one you referred to at the top of the broadcast, and that is a joint agreement with Russia to develop peaceful nuclear energy, something that the Bush administration has put a very high priority on for a long time and really wanted to get a deal finished before the end of this administration, and also one that the Russians were very interested in. Now it seems that has really no chance of getting moved for the remainder of this term. Other than that, the United States has very little leverage with Russia. I think the European countries have more leverage with Russia. And going back to what Moises said, I mean, the European Union, has some big decisions to face here with respect to the future of Ukraine. And, there are a lot of messages that the Europeans can send to Russia, but in a sense, they have even less leverage than the United States because of their dependence on Russia for oil and gas supplies.
Right. But the hope in the Bush administration and NATO is that, one, this will finally inspire the Europeans to find alternative courses of energy, alternative pipelines, which they have been very fractious and not agreeing to up until now. There's also the hope that most immediately a European plan to waive Russian visas for travel to European countries, that will not go through. And above all, that what you will get in response, and I think this is the most likely response, is a big uptick in economic aid programs to both Georgia and Ukraine. Mm. But I think one of the reasons why the Ukraine is really the next potential flashpoint here is because there have been discussions going on about the initial phase of NATO membership, which is called the Membership Action Program, MAP. There's been a lot of debate about not whether to do that and how provocative it would be. And we will see, I think, a lot of tussling between the Bush administration and the Europeans over this.
Moises.
The question here is, what are the forces that will contain Russia's behavior and Russia's aggressiveness? And as we have gone down the list, the United States has gone from superpower to spectator. The European Union is looking for ways to decide if they can act together and so on. So what can really be the force that contains Russia? And there, the big surprise is that it may be the oligarchs.
Yes, exactly.
The highly corrupt, the mega wealthy, very powerful members of the economic elites that surround the Kremlin.
Because
in fact,
they
many
would...
of them are, these are these very wealthy tycoons that grab the enterprises in Russia, the banks and the steel mills and the mines.
And they would see that wealth threat.
They are, what they're seeing is that the stock market in Russia plummeted, that they have lost billions of dollars, that Russia can become isolated, that they opportunities to come and spend their monies in the West may be limited, that sending their children to premier schools in the West may also suffer. So it may be that the much derided corrupt oligarchs end up being the ones that contain a major escalation.
Well, it's not just the oligarchs. It's basically the forces of modernization in Russia, which is broader than just the oligarchs. It's everyone. It's those members of the government who sort of more the technocrats who, you know, Putin says he doesn't see an advantage in joining the World Trade Organization, but that's kind of an emotional statement because there are powerful advantages, very important advantages for Russia. And I think wiser, calmer minds in Moscow recognize that Russia's future does not lie in being isolated from the capitalist West.
But who's in charge?
Yeah.
Is it Medvedev? Is it
It's Putin. This is Vladimir Putin's Russia, his popularity, which is based on these revanchist moves to restore, you know, what's left of Greater Russia, are enormously popular. And while I agree with both Moises and Tom about the potential power of the forces of modernization, I think it's a very thin reed to hang our hopes on, because what Putin has done in recent years internally is to gradually curtail the power of the oligarchs. He's put all of his old KGB and FSB pals in charge of many of the largest state companies. This is his country, and there is no, and I repeat, no current serious political challenge to him. So I don't really think there's much of a potential hope there.
All right. Let's move on to Iraq. There was news yesterday that security gains in the Anwar province in western Iraq will enable the U.S. military to turn over responsibilities to the Iraqi military. A major milestone, Tom.
Well, it would sure seem to be, Diane, especially considering that Anbar province has, from 2003 on, been Sunni territory. It's been the scene of some of the bloodiest resistance to the U.S. occupation. And also, it's a province where tensions between the Sunni leadership and the Shiites in the national government is most acute. Prime Minister Maliki has said some very negative things about the Awakening Councils, the ex-Sunni insurgents who are so crucial to the progress there. He's actually sort of been trying to arrest them and going after them. So we see this. We see this potentially risky development here where the Iraqi security forces will be taking, effective Monday, responsibility for the Anbar province at the same time that the national government has been going after these local Sunni leaders.
Yeah, I mean, the hopeful sign here is not only the stability of Anbar, but the freeing up of Marines to go to Afghanistan, which is another huge trouble spot and shows how interlinked so many of these crises are. But the danger is the increasing feistiness, and one might even say the hubris, of the Maliki government. With one of the great benefits of the last year or so since the surge began has been the quelling of most sectarian violence. But Maliki has come out against the Sons of Iraq, one of the Awakening movements. He may not be willing to leave Anbar to Sunni control. And whereas several months ago he had sent encouraging signs by quashing his fellow Shiite Muqtada al-Sadr, if now he's angering the Sunnis, which he seems to be, you have the potential for a resurgence of those sectarian.
And one of Maliki's senior officials was arrested.
as he was entering the country. I was thinking about the arrest as it was flying into the country of a very senior official associated with the opposition to Maliki. And he was accused of being a member of a group that had assassinated in the past month or so several individuals. But the point I wanted to make also on this is that Iraq, formally now the Iraqi government controls has security control in 10 of 18 provinces. In some instances, it's a largely symbolic kind of control. In others, it's very real. And in the case of Anbar, in fact, the Iraqi government had control, with the U.S. military just stationed in bases and just acting in very specific instances. So what the larger question here is how sustainable this is, and how real it is. And we have seen lots of shifts, and we have seen lots of instances where we were thinking that a reality had become permanent, only to discover that it was very transient.
So the question is, how many troops have we got there? What's the timetable for getting people out, Tom?
Well, as Michael suggested, we have something like 25,000 Marines in Anbar alone. And this would, I think that is supposed to go down by a significant number. And as Michael says, that would free them to go to Afghanistan. This is a huge development. The other promising development that could also permit a reduction in U.S. forces is that Mukhtar al-Sadr this week said that he is going to disband once and for all his militia forces, the Mehdi army, and convert his movement into a political movement. Now, you know, we have to take everything that Mukhtar al-Sadr says with a grain of salt, but if in fact this has been a strategic decision on his part, that would greatly improve the security situation in southern Iraq.
Tom Jelton, he's correspondent for NPR and author of a new book titled Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We've got lots of callers. I do want to open the phones here. Let's go first to Deer Park, New York. Good morning, Holly. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Diane, for taking my call. Perhaps one should consider this. When Putin changed the proletariat's payments for gas and oil from the American dollar to the ruble, we should have seen this coming. We should have seen Georgia and the Ukraine coming because of the reasonability of changing it from the American dollar to the ruble.
What do you think, Michael Hirsch?
Well, I think that was just one symptom of what's been evolving as new Russian nationalism since the Putin era began. I mean, this is a guy who has made plain since he became president in 2000. The first thing he did ruthlessly was to go into Chechnya again and crush the rebellion there. He has always been seen as a figure who was going to restore Russian greatness. Which is another reason why I think we might have thought a little bit more about whether Georgia and Ukraine were a bridge too far for NATO, and whether a little more realpolitik, such as, for example, we've used dealing with Taiwan and China, might have been more advisable, where you don't provoke an emerging great power beyond its level of tolerance, even if you don't agree with what its leadership is doing.
Let's talk about Afghanistan. Before we have to go to a break, you've had lots of deaths there this week and lots of charges back and forth. What's happening, Tom?
Well, Diane, there was an airstrike in Afghanistan, and local Afghan leaders said that 60 people, 90 people were killed, including 60 children in that. And then some UN investigators came in, or UN officials implicitly backed up those charges. However, the U.S. military leadership has vigorously disputed those claims and has pointed out that so far the evidence for this great number of casualties has mostly been statements from local people, as opposed to more clearer things like the U.S. military is pointing out, for example, that there's no evident big graves that have been dug, and there's no physical evidence that the casualties of this size took place. So this is very much in dispute. The U.S. military is, as I say, vigorously disputing this. I think we're going to have to wait to see a more thorough investigation in order to reach conclusions that are based on something more than the simple statements of people.
Moises.
And this controversy has driven a wedge between President Hamid Karzai and American forces, and between the UN, the United Nations, and NATO. President Karzai has to run for office again next year. The presence of NATO forces and of American forces is becoming more and more an issue of contention with the local population. We may be seeing an increasing trend that resembles Iraq. By that I mean a situation where foreign troops are essentially hated, and there is a very, very strong nationalistic reaction against them, and there are all sorts of incentives, also fueled by Pakistan, to strike against foreign occupiers.
Moises Naim, he's editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine and author of a book titled Illicit, How Smugglers, Traffickers, and Copycats Are Hijacking the Global Economy. After a short break, we'll come back to talk about Pakistan. Take your calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Miriam Muscarolis and Grant Abramson, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming, by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org, and by AMARC Foundation, supporting procon.org with the 2008 presidential candidates' positions on many issues at procon.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, crucial moments and courageous decisions in presidential history. We talk with Michael Beschloss about his book Presidential Courage and hear audio clips featuring FDR, Harry Truman, and JFK. Also, we remember lesbian activist Del Martin, who has died at the age of 87. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And we're back with the international portion of our Friday News Roundup this week with Moises Naim. He's with Foreign Policy magazine, Tom Jelton of NPR, and Michael Hirsch of Newsweek, author of a book titled At War With Ourselves. Do join us, 800-433-8255. 8850. Let's go now to Phoenix, Arizona. Good morning, Tom. You're on the air.
Good morning. You know, I don't know whether we told Georgia to attack or not, but considering that this government, I use the term government, not Bush or Republican, because they're both complicit in this, has been manipulating the American population through fear-mongering in order to start unjust, unconstitutional wars, killing hundreds of thousands of innocent people, taking away our civil rights, I wouldn't put it past these maniacs to do something like this. And I'm just curious when the American people are going to stand up and realize that both these parties are selling our country down the drain.
Michael Hirsch.
Well, in a couple of months, presumably we'll be standing up and making a decision on the next president. I think that for all the strategic and tactical errors of the Bush administration on many fronts, including invading Iraq, I just don't think we have the evidence to suggest that this was George W. Bush's or Dick Cheney's August surprise, if you will.
Is somebody looking into that? Are there journalists? You know, because it took a long time to really get to the bottom of the invasion of Iraq. Is someone, are reporters looking into these questions because they've been raised again and again?
Well, you quoted a LA Times report this morning, Diane, which I have not seen. I think you said it was just this morning that looked at this Cheney aide's visit to Georgia preceding the Russian action there. So I think the answer must be yes. You know, the question is, you know, if nothing turns up, then sort of our tensions turn elsewhere. But for the moment, I'm sure that there are.
All right. Let's talk about Pakistan. The leading candidate to replace Pervez Musharraf as president, who happens to be Benazir Bhutto's widower, Asif Ali Zardari, is holed up in a guarded compound. What's happening, Moises?
What's happening is that a country that was inherently very unstable and dangerous and complicated is becoming even more so. And with the exit of Pervez Musharraf now with this Asif Zardari, the president of the Pakistan People's Party, who has been accused of corruption, who has been in jail for corruption, whose money has been frozen in Swiss bank accounts, and has been accused of suffering from mental illnesses, is now becoming at the verge of becoming a very powerful person in Pakistan. But the name that listeners and all of us need to keep in mind for the future is the name of General Afshak Parvez Kayani. He is Pakistan's chief of staff of the Pakistani army, and the Pakistani army is the central player, is the institution that is more permanent, that has most resources, that not only has the guns but also has the enterprises. They manage and run companies and large chunks of the economy, and they are the only institution that seems to have the permanence. And that will bring us back to the sad situation in which we have a military man running the show. I hope it doesn't happen, but everything points that the dynamics, the political dynamics there between Benazir Bhutto, widower, and Nawaz Sharif, who is the head of the opposition, the Pakistani Muslim League, and are going to be very weak candidates, and we are going to see a lot of turnover there.
And what's that going to mean for U.S. relations with Pakistan, Michael?
Well, again, you know, who's our guy? Zardari is the current favorite, but as Moises pointed out, he has all of these problems. The second most popular politician, Nawaz Sharif, is seen as a conservative Muslim who would not take on the sort of pro-Taliban, al-Qaeda-linked groups that we want. You know, the fear, as Moises suggested, is that a very old cycle in Pakistan repeats itself, mm-hmm. where democracy flourishes very briefly, basically breaks down amid charges and cross-charges of corruption and the lack of anyone able to gain control. Now, it's interesting that Kayani came in as chief of staff of the army saying he wanted to pull the army out of politics. He did not want to become the next Musharraf because obviously he saw what happened to Musharraf. So I think the real big question will be whether he, you know, sees himself as the savior at some point, realizing that his country is falling apart politically. And this is a, you know, very, very dangerous situation. Could directly affects what's happening to us in Afghanistan across the border.
Well, Diane, you asked the question, how will the United States respond to this? And if you go back over 20 years, when the United States has faced a choice between stability in Pakistan under a military government or instability under a civilian government, the United States, through Republican and Democratic administrations alike, has always sided with the with stability. And with the stakes higher now than they have ever been, I think we should not be surprised if the United States would sort of look the other way at some point. I mean, I'm going to way out on a limb here. But given that it's the Pakistani army who has been leading the fight against the Taliban in the border regions now, really sort of going beyond the imperative of the civilian government. It's the Pakistani army who's been doing that. I think right now the United States sees the Pakistani army as it's one of its few reliable allies in terms of the fight against militants in that border area.
But reliable has to be put in quotes, because at the same time as the army has seized the initiative and it seems to be largely ignoring the civilian government, it's also cutting deals with various tribal leaders, militants, that it basically sees as willing not to attack inside Pakistan. You've had a number of very serious attacks in recent days and weeks by Pakistani Taliban. The Pakistani elites are now looking to divide those that they, the army and the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, thinks it can control strategically, as it has always supported these groups, and is hoping to get them to just focus on Afghanistan across the border, where we in NATO are. So you do have... you know, it's really just the you know, it's just a question of who is the least worst alternative.
All right, to Indianapolis. Good morning, Eddie. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I was wondering, within regards to Russia, if there's a relationship between Iran and Russia, and if Russia could be feeling very emboldened to be able to go ahead with some of these tactics based on a strengthened relationship with Iran, possibly.
Moises.
Yes, there is a relationship. It is a close relationship. Well, let's start by recognizing that oil plays a very important role here, that Putin and all of his ambitions and all of his capacities today are rooted in oil being sold at more than $110, $112, and even got to $145 at some point. So without oil, or with oil at lower prices, Putin would be a different challenge for the world, for Europe and the United States. With Iran, there are several issues. There are oil issues, there are nuclear issues, there are pipeline issues about how to transport, and there is an alliance of a variety of ways. But it has to be said also that Russia has stated that it's not in their interest to see a nuclear-armed Iran. They have been very clear about that.
All right, to Spotsylvania, Virginia. Hi there, Jim. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Diane, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Something to run by the panel, and it's hadn't had much talk about it, but these two things I'm going to bring up are intertwined. The possibility of China and Iraq cutting a deal for the development of a gigantic oil field. I don't know, it was estimated, I guess, $3 billion, but it's more than that. And also with the stranglehold Russia has on pipelines and resource routes, and also back to China with their influence in Sudan. I've been rolling over some scenarios in my mind, and I keep getting these very grim pictures of this, and the whole Eastern Hemisphere is going to pot, as far as I'm concerned.
Tom Gelton.
Well, I think Jim is referring to a $3 billion deal contract that Iraq and China signed this week. under which China would help develop those Iraqi oil fields. And of course, there's a real convergence of interests here. Iraq desperately needs outside help to develop those oil fields. Right now, U.S. oil companies are very problematic because of security concerns. China could come into this situation in Iraq as a kind of a neutral party with no political baggage. So from Iraq's point of view, it makes sense. And of course, China has this almost insatiable demand for oil right now, looking everywhere for new sources, new supplies. So I think this is probably a deal that's got some real promise.
Yeah, I mean, so much for the Iraq war, you know, being about securing American oil interests. But Jim raises also some other very interesting issues about how interconnected many of these crises now are. I mean, just one example of the dangers of confronting Russia over Georgia, we desperately need Russian pressure on Iran and European pressure on Iran. But if the Europeans decide to bypass Russian gas pipelines, the best alternatives actually run through Iran, and that gives Iran in turn more leverage in its negotiations in terms of thwarting this effort at economic isolation of Iran. And as we know, you know, this hasn't been in the news because there's been so much other news, but Iran continues to go forthrightly into and develop its nuclear program and its centrifuges. So this becomes an enormously complex diplomatic problem that is almost certainly, along with all of these other problems we've been discussing, going to land directly on the desk of the next president on his day of inauguration.
2 points. China is a global player, and China is not always a source of instability, but it can be a source of stability, and it can be good news. It's not a bad thing that now China has huge interests in the Arab countries, in the Middle East, and also in Iraq. That brings their interest for stability in that region aligned to that of the United States. China is now, for what Tom was saying about its insatiable need for energy sources, is also a very important player and has strong interests in maintaining stability in some of these arenas. And that's something that is perfectly aligned with the interest of the United States.
All right, to Miami, Florida. Hi there, Lisa. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I just wanted to make a quick comment. I happen to be 44, and two of my occupations in life over the course of the last couple of decades, wonderful professional high-end positions, I have been associates and assistants to people who have been as far apart in age as Senator McCain has been. And so I've had that cutting-edge difference that is now taking place in this new presidential situation that's going on right now. And I personally think that although I don't know just yet which direction I'm going to vote, I have not yet made up my mind, I think that this is not the worst thing in the world. She may not necessarily have all of the tools just yet, but I'm sure that there'll be a huge barrage of advisors that will fill her gaps in quite quickly with all of the things that she will need.
All right, Lisa, thanks for your call at 6 minutes before the hour. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. The age question, the experience question, in light of all the issues we've been talking about this morning.
Well, I mean, I think it's only fair to point out that the similar argument was made about George W. Bush and all of the wise men he was surrounding himself with. And I think it's now sort of commonly concluded that that model didn't work out very well in terms of relying on these gray eminences around you. And so I think that, the questions are going to have to be raised directly about Sarah Palin and her ability to master foreign policy. I mean, I think, for example, the single debate, as I understand it, she's going to have with Joe Biden, who has been, a foreign policy maven for 35 years, is going to be very significant. How is she going to perform? And again, people are going to have this question in the back of their minds. Well, this is a person who actually could step into the presidency.
Michael mentioned George Bush and the advisors that led him into Iraq. We could go further back to the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962, where we had a young and untested president. And thank God he did not listen to his advisors. Thank God that he used his own judgment in addressing that situation, because if he had listened to some of the very senior people who were telling him what to do, we would have ended up in a very different place.
As our conversation in the last hour shows, we're living in a very complicated world.
And we haven't even talked about North Korea, Moises.
And again, another nuclear threat, another situation where we thought we had made progress, where a deal had been struck and now is unraveling. Again, I would not put too much credence on the notion that this is going to be a huge crisis. The North Koreans have mastered the art of creating crisis in order to get and extract more concessions. So they are good at this back and forth and creating these situations only as a negotiating block.
I just wanted to add that a lot of these crises will be resolved differently depending on whether McCain and Obama get whoever gets in.
Give me an example.
Well, take McCain's position on Russia. He wants to cast it out of the G8. There's almost certainly going to be a big disagreement between him and the Europeans over this issue. The Europeans don't want to do that. He's never been a big fan of the North Korea agreement. Ironically enough, the one area where there may be the most agreement between President McCain or President Obama would be on Iraq, because of the 2011 timetable that the Iraqi government has now set down. Even though this has been where they argued most, in practice they may end up pursuing more of a similar policy on that than they would on some of these other issues.
And I think the same for Afghanistan. I think the consensus now that the United States really needs to increase its presence in Afghanistan is equal on both sides.
Tom Jelton of NPR, Michael Hirsch of Newsweek, Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane.
And have a great weekend, everybody. Please stay safe. We are back with you live on Tuesday. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Emily Robichaud answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.